Disc 8.
We did. The first trap was a crude kind of windmill which produced a hearty hammering noise. We fixed it up about half a mile away. It worked. It drew them away from our fence and from elsewhere. When there were several hundreds of them clustered about it, Susan and I drove over there and turned the flamethrowers on them. It worked fairly well a second time, too. But after that, only a very few of them paid any attention to it. Our next move was to build a kind of stout bay inwards from the fence, and then remove part of the main fence itself, replacing it by a gate. We had chosen a point within earshot of the lighting engine, and we left the gate open. After a couple of days, we dropped the gate and destroyed the couple of hundred or so that had come into the pen. That, too, was fairly successful to begin with. But not if we tried it twice in the same place. And even in other places, the numbers we netted dropped steadily. A tour of the boundaries every few days with a flamethrower could have kept the numbers down effectively, but it would have taken a lot of time and soon have run us out of fuel. A flamethrower's consumption is high, and the stocks held for it in the arms depots were not large. Once we finished it, our valuable flamethrowers would become little better than junk, for I knew neither the formula for an efficient fuel nor the method for producing it. On the two or three occasions we tried mortar bombs on concentrations of triffids, the results were disappointing. Triffids share with trees the ability to take a lot of damage without lethal harm. As time went on, the numbers collected along the fence continued to increase in spite of our traps and occasional holocausts. They didn't try anything or do anything there. They simply settled down, wriggled their roots into the soil, and remained. At a distance, they looked as inactive as any other hedge, and but for the pattering that some few of them were sure to be making, they might have been no more remarkable. But if one doubted their alertness, it was only necessary to take a car down the lane. To do so was to run a gauntlet of such viciously slashing stings that it was necessary to stop the car at the main road and wipe the windscreen clear of poison. Now and then one of us would have a new idea for their discouragement, such as spraying the ground beyond the fence with a strong arsenical solution, but the retreats we caused were only temporary. We'd been trying out a variety of such dodges for a year or more before the day when Susan came running into our room early one morning to tell us that the things had broken in and were all round the house. She had got up early to do the milking as usual. The sky outside her bedroom window was grey, but when she went downstairs, she found everything there in complete darkness. She realized that should not be so, and turned on the light. The moment she saw leathery green leaves pressed against the windows, she guessed what had happened. I crossed the bedroom on tiptoe and pulled the window shut sharply. Even as it closed, a sting whipped up from below and smacked against the glass. We looked down on a thicket of triffids, standing 10 or 12 deep against the wall of the house. The flamethrowers were in one of the outhouses. I took no risks when I went to fetch them. In thick clothing and gloves, with a leather helmet and goggles beneath the mesh mask, I hacked away through the throng of triffids with the largest carving knife I could find. The stings whipped and slapped at the wire mesh so frequently that they wetted, and the poison began to come through in a fine spray. It misted the goggles, and the first thing I did in the outhouse was to wash it off my face. I dare not use more than a brief, low-aimed jet from one of the throwers to clear my way back for fear of setting the door and window frames alight, but it moved and agitated them enough for me to get back unmolested. Gisella and Susan stood by with fire extinguishers while I, still looking like a cross between a deep-sea diver and a man from Mars, leant from the upper windows on each side of the house in turn and played the thrower over the besieging mob of the brutes. It did not take very long to incinerate a number of them and get the rest on the move. Susan, now dressed for the job, took the second thrower and started on the, to her, highly congenial task of hunting them down, while I set off across the fields to find the source of the trouble. That was not difficult. From the first rise I was able to see the spot where triffids were still lurching into our enclosure in a stream of tossing stems and waving leaves. They fanned out a little on the nearer side, but all of them were bound in the direction of the house. It was simple to head them off. A jet in front stopped them, One to either side started them back on the way they had come. An occasional spurt over them and dripping among them hurried them up, and turned back later comers. 20 yards or so away, a part of the fence was lying flat with the posts snapped off. I rigged it up temporarily there and then, and played the thrower back and forth, giving the things enough of a scorching to prevent more trouble for a few hours at least. Gisella, Susan, and I spent most of the day repairing the breach. 2 more days passed before Susan and I could be sure that we had searched every corner of the enclosure and accounted for the very last of the intruders. We followed that up with an inspection of the whole length of the fence and a reinforcement of all doubtful sections. 4 months later, they broke in again. This time a number of broken triffids lay in the gap. Our impression was that they had been crushed in the pressure that had built up against the fence before it gave way, and that falling with it, they had been trampled by the rest. It was clear that we should have to take new defensive measures. No part of our fence was any stronger than that which had given way. Electrification seemed the most likely means of keeping them at a distance. To power it, I found an army generator mounted on a trailer and towed it home. Susan and I set to work on the wiring. Before we had completed it, the brutes were through again in another place. I believe that system would have been completely effective if we could have kept it in action all the time, or even most of the time. But against that, there was the fuel consumption. Petrol was one of the most valuable of our stores. Food of some kind we could always hope to grow, but when petrol and diesel oil were no longer available, much more than our mere convenience would be gone with them. There would be no more expeditions, and consequently no more replenishments of supplies. The primitive life would start in earnest. So, from motives of conservation, the barrier wire was only charged for some minutes 2 or 3 times a day. It caused the triffids to recoil a few yards, and thereby stopped them building up pressure against the fence. As an additional guard, we ran an alarm wire on the inner fence to enable us to deal with any breaks before they became serious. The weakness lay in the triffids' apparent ability to learn, in at least a limited way, from experience. We found, for instance, that they grew accustomed to our practice of charging the wire for a while night and morning. We began to notice that they were usually clear of the wire at our customary time for starting the engine, and they began to close in again soon after it had stopped. Whether they actually associated the charged condition of the wire with the sound of the engine was impossible to say then. But later, we had little doubt that they did. It was easy enough to make our running times erratic. But Susan, for whom they were continually a source of inimical study, soon began to maintain that the period for which the shock kept them clear was growing steadily shorter. Nevertheless, the electrified wire and occasional attacks upon them in the sections where they were densest kept us free of incursions for over a year, and of those that occurred later, we had warning enough to stop them being more than a minor nuisance. Within the safety of our compound, we continued to learn about agriculture, and life settled gradually into a routine. On a day in the summer of our 6th year, Gisella and I went down to the coast together, travelling there in the half-tracked vehicle that I customarily used now that the roads were growing so bad. It was a holiday for her. Months had passed since she had been outside the fence. The care of the place and the babies had kept her far too tied to make more than a few necessary trips. But now we had reached the stage where we felt that Susan could safely be left in charge sometimes, and we had a feeling of release as we climbed up and ran over the tops of the hills. On the lower southern slopes we stopped the car for a while and sat there. It was a perfect June day with only a few light clouds flecking a pure blue sky. The sun shone down on the beaches and the sea beyond just as brightly as it had in the days when those same beaches had been crowded with bathers and the sea dotted with little boats. We looked down on it in silence for some minutes. Gisella said, "Don't you still feel sometimes that if you were to close your eyes for a bit you might open them again to find it all as it was, Bill?" "I do." "Not often now," I told her. "But I've had to see so much more of it than you have. All the same, sometimes." "And look at the gulls. just as they used to be. There are many more birds this year, I agreed. I'm glad of that. Viewed impressionistically from a distance, the little town was still the same jumble of small red-roofed houses and bungalows populated mostly by a comfortably retired middle class. But it was an impression that could not last more than a few minutes. Though the tiles still showed, the walls were barely visible. The tidy gardens had vanished under an unchecked growth of green, patched in colour here and there by the descendants of carefully cultivated flowers. Even the roads looked like strips of green carpet from this distance. When we reached them, we should find that the effect of soft verdure was illusory. They would be matted with coarse, tough weeds.
Only so few years ago, Josella said reflectively, people were wailing about the way those bungalows were destroying the countryside. Now look at them.
The countryside is having its revenge, all right, I said. Nature seemed about finished then.
Who would have thought the old man had so much blood in him? It rather frightens me. It's as if everything were breaking out, rejoicing that we're finished and that it's free to go its own way, I wonder. Have we been just fooling ourselves since it happened? Do you think we really are finished with Bill?
I'd had plenty more time when I was out on my foragings to wonder about that than she had.
If you weren't you, darling, I might make an answer out of the right heroic mould,
the kind of wishful thinking that so often passes for faith and resolution.
But as I am me,
I'll give you the honest answer.
Not quite.
And while there's life, there's hope. We looked on the scene before us for some seconds in silence. I think, I amplified, only think, mind you, that we have a narrow chance. So narrow that it's going to take a long, long time to get back. If it weren't for the Triffids, I'd say there was a very good chance indeed, though still taking a longish time. But the Triffids are a real factor. They are something that no rising civilization has had to fight before. Are they going to take the world off us? Or are we going to be able to stop them? The real problem is to find some simple way of dealing with them. We aren't so badly off. We can hold them away. But our grandchildren? What are they going to do about them? Are they going to have to spend all their lives in human reservations, only kept free of Triffids by unending toil? I'm quite sure there is a simple way. The trouble is that simple ways come out of such complicated research, and we haven't the resources.
But surely we have all the resources there ever were, just for the taking, Josella put in.
Material, yes, but mental, no. What we need is a team. A team of experts really out to deal with the Triffids for good and all. Something could be done, I'm sure. Something along the lines of a selective killer, perhaps. If we could produce the right hormones to create a state of imbalance in Triffids, but not enough in other things, it must be possible if you have enough brain power turned onto the job.
If you think that, why don't you try? She asked.
Too many reasons. First, I'm not up to it. A very mediocre biochemist, and there's only one of me. There'd have to be a lab and equipment. More than that, there'd have to be time. And there are too many things which I have to do as it is. But even if I had the ability, then there would have to be the means of producing synthetic hormones in huge quantities. It would be a job for a regular factory. But before that, there must be the research team.
People could be trained.
Yes, when enough of them can be spared from the mere business of keeping alive. I've collected a mass of biochemical books in the hope that perhaps sometime there will be people who can make use of them. I shall teach David all I can, and he must hand it on. But unless there is leisure for work on it sometime, I can see nothing ahead but the reservations. Josella frowned down on a group of four Triffids ambling across a field below us.
They used to say that a man's really serious rivals were the insects. It seems to me that the Triffids have something in common with some kinds of insects. Oh, I know that biologically they're plants. What I mean is they don't bother about their individuals, and their individuals don't bother about themselves. Separately, they have something which looks slightly like intelligence. Collectively, it looks a great deal more like it. They sort of work together for a purpose, the way ants or bees do. Yet you could say that not one of them is aware of any purpose or scheme, although he's part of it. It's all very queer. Probably impossible for us to understand, anyway. They're so different. It seems to me to go against all our ideas of inheritable characteristics. Is there something in a bee or a triffid which is a gene of social organisation? Or does an ant have a gene of architecture? And if they have these things, why haven't we in all this time developed a gene for language or cooking? Anyway, whatever it is, the triffids do seem to have something like it. It may be that no single individual knows why it keeps hanging around our fence. But the whole lot together knows that its purpose is to get us. And that sooner or later, it will.
There are still things that can happen to stop that, I said. I didn't mean to make you feel quite despondent about it all.
I don't. Except sometimes when I'm tired. Usually I'm much too busy to worry over what may happen years ahead. No, as a rule, I don't go much beyond getting a little sad. A sort of gentle melancholy that the 18th century thought so estimable. I go sentimental when you play records. There is something rather frightening about a great orchestra which has passed away, still playing on to a little group of people hemmed in and gradually growing more primitive. It takes me back, and I begin to feel sad with thinking of all the things we can never do again, however things go now. Don't you sometimes feel like that?
I admitted. But I find that I accept the present more easily as it goes on. I suppose that if there were wishes that could be granted, I would wish the old world back. But there'd be a condition. You see, in spite of everything, I'm happier inside me than I ever was before. You know that, don't you, Josie? She put her hand on mine. I feel that too.
No, what saddens me is not so much the things we've lost, as the things the babies will never have the chance to know.
It's going to be a problem to bring them up with hopes and ambitions, I acknowledged. We can't help being orientated backwards, but they mustn't look back all the time. A tradition of a vanished golden age and ancestors who were magicians would be a most damning thing. Whole races have had that sort of inferiority complex which has sunk into lassitude on the tradition of a glorious past. But how are we going to stop that kind of thing from happening?
If I were a child now, she said reflectively, I think I should want a reason of some kind. Unless I was given it, that is, if I were allowed to think that I had been born into a world which had been quite pointlessly destroyed, I should find living quite pointless too. That does make it awfully difficult, because it seems to be just what has happened.
She paused, pondering. Then she added,
Do you think we should be justified in starting a myth to help them? A story of a world that was wonderfully clever but so wicked that it had to be destroyed, or destroyed itself by accident. Something like the Flood again. That wouldn't crush them with inferiority. It could give the incentive to build, and this time to build something better.
Yes, I said, considering it. Yes. It's often a good idea to tell children the truth. Kind of makes things easier for them later on. Only why pretend it's a myth? Josella demurred at that.
How do you mean? The Triffids were, well, they were somebody's fault or mistake, I admit, but the rest...
I don't think we can blame anyone too much for the Triffids. The extracts they give were very valuable in the circumstances. Nobody can ever see what a major discovery is going to lead to, whether it's a new kind of engine or a Triffid, and we cope with them all right in normal conditions. We benefited quite a lot from them, as long as the conditions were to their disadvantage.
But it wasn't our fault the conditions changed. It was just one of those things, like earthquakes or hurricanes, what an insurance company would call an act of God.
Maybe that's just what it was. A judgment. Certainly we never brought that comet. Didn't we, Gisella? Are you quite sure of that? She turned to look at me. What do you mean, Bill? How could we?
What I mean, my dear, is, was it a comet at all?
You see, there's an old superstitious distrust of comets pretty well grained in. I know we were modern enough not to kneel down in the streets to pray to them. But all the same, it's a phobia with centuries of standing. They've been portents and symbols of heavenly wrath and warnings that the end is at hand, and used in any amount of stories and prophecies. So when you get an astonishing celestial phenomenon, what more natural than to attribute it straight off to a comet? A denial would take time to get around, and time was just what there was not. And when utter disaster follows, it just confirms it for everyone that it must have been a comet. Gisella was looking at me very hard.
Bill, are you trying to tell me that you don't think it was a comet at all?
Just exactly that, I agreed.
But I don't understand. What else could it have been?
I opened a vacuum-packed tin of cigarettes and lit one for each of us. You remember what Michael Beadley said about the tightrope we'd all been walking on for years?
Yes, but, well, I think that what happened was that we came off it. And that a few of us just managed to survive the crash.
I drew on my cigarette, looking out at the sea and at the infinite blue sky above it.
Up there, I went on. Up there, there were, and maybe there still are, unknown numbers of satellite weapons circling round and round the Earth. Just a lot of dormant menaces touring around waiting for someone or something to set them off.
What was in them?
You don't know.
I don't know.
Top secret stuff.
All we've heard is guesses. Fissile materials, radioactive dusts, bacteria, viruses. Now suppose that one type happened to have been constructed especially to emit radiations that our eyes would not stand. Something that would burn out or at least damage the optic nerve.
Gisella gripped my hand. Oh, no, Bill. No, they couldn't. That'd be diabolical. Oh, I can't believe that. No, no, Bill.
My sweet, all the things up there were diabolical. Then suppose they were a mistake, or perhaps an accident. Maybe such an accident as actually encountering a shower of comet debris, if you like, which starts some of these things popping. Somebody starts talking about comets, it might not be politic to deny that, and there turned out to be so little time anyway. Well, naturally these things would have been intended to operate close to the ground, where the effect would be spread over a definitely calculable area. But they start going off out there, in space. Or maybe when they hit the atmosphere. Either way, they're operating so far up that people around the world can receive direct radiations from them. Just what did happen is anyone's guess now. But one thing I'm quite certain of, that somehow or other we brought this lot down on ourselves.
And there was that plague, too. It wasn't typhoid, you know.
I find that it's just the wrong side of coincidence for me to believe that out of all the thousands of years in which a destructive comet could arrive, it happens to do so just a few years after we've succeeded in establishing satellite weapons. Don't you?
No, I think that we kept on that tightrope quite a while, considering the things that might have happened.
But sooner or later the foot had to slip.
Well, when you put it that way,
murmured Gisella. She broke off and was lost in silence for quite a while. Then she said,
I suppose in a way that should be more horrible than the idea of nature striking blindly at us. And yet I don't think it is. It makes me feel less hopeless about things because it makes them at least comprehensible. If it was like that, then it is at least a thing that can be prevented from happening again. Just one more of the mistakes our very great-grandchildren are going to have to avoid. And oh dear, there were so many, many mistakes.
But we can warn them.
Hmm.
Well, I said. Anyway, once they've beaten the Triffids and pulled themselves out of this mess, they'll have plenty of scope for making brand new mistakes of their very own.
Poor little things,
she said, as if she were gazing down rows of increasingly great-grandchildren.
It's not much that we're offering them, is it?
People used to say life is what you make it.
That, my dear Bill, outside very narrow limits, is just a load of... Well, I don't want to be rude. But I believe my Uncle Ted used to say that, until somebody dropped a bomb which took both his legs off. It changed his mind. And nothing that I personally did caused me to be living at all now.
She threw away the remains of her cigarette.
Bill, what have we done to be the lucky ones in all this? Every now and then, when I stop feeling overworked and selfish, that is, I think how lucky we really have been. And I want to give thanks to somebody or other. But then I find I feel that if there were anybody or anything to give thanks to, they'd have chosen such a much more deserving case than me. It's all very confusing to a simple girl.
And I said, feel that if there were anybody or anything at all in the driving seat, quite a lot of the things in history could not have happened. But I don't let it worry me a lot.
We've had luck, my sweet.
If it changes tomorrow, well, it changes. Whatever it does, it can't take away the time we've had together. That's been more than I ever deserved, and more than most men get in a lifetime. We sat there a little longer looking at the empty sea, and then drove down to the little town. After a search which produced most of the things on our wants list, we went down to picnic on the shore in the sunshine, with a good stretch of shingle behind us over which no Triffid could approach unheard.
We must do more of this while we can, Josella said. Now that Susan's growing up, I needn't be nearly so tied.
If anybody ever earned the right to let up a bit, you have, I agreed. I said it with a feeling that I would like us to go together and say a last farewell to places and things we had known while it was still possible. Every year now the prospect of imprisonment would grow closer. Already to get northward from Scherning it was necessary to make a detour of many miles to pass the country that had reverted to marshland. All the roads were rapidly becoming worse with the erosion by rain and streams, and the roots that broke up the surfaces. The time in which one would still be able to get an oil tanker back to the house was already becoming measurable. One day one of them would fail to make its way along the lane, and very likely block it for good. A half-track would continue to run over ground that was dry enough, but as time went on it would be increasingly difficult to find a route open enough even for that.
And we must have one real last fling, I said. You shall dress up again, and we'll go to...
Shh! Interrupted Josella, holding up one finger and turning her ear to the wind. I held my breath and strained my ears. There was a feeling rather than a sound of throbbing in the air. It was faint, but gradually swelling.
It is. It's a plane, Josella said.
We looked to the west, shading our eyes with our hands. The humming was still little more than the buzzing of an insect. The sound increased so slowly that it could come from nothing but a helicopter. Any other kind of craft would have passed over us or out of hearing in the time it was taking. Josella saw it first. A dot, a little out from the coast and apparently coming our way parallel with the shore. We stood up and started to wave. As the dot grew larger, we waved more wildly, and not very sensibly shouted at the tops of our voices. The pilot could not have failed to see us there on the open beach had he come on, but that was what he did not do. A few miles short of us, he turned abruptly north to pass inland. We went on waving madly, hoping that he might yet catch sight of us. But there was no indecision in the machine's course, no variation of the engine note. Deliberately and imperturbably, it droned away toward the hills. We lowered our arms and looked at one another.
If it can come once, it can come again, said Josella sturdily, but not very convincingly.
but the sight of the machine had changed our day for us. It destroyed quite a lot of resignation we had carefully built up. We had been saying to ourselves that there must be other groups, but they wouldn't be in any better position than we were, more likely in a worse. But when a helicopter could come sailing in like a sight and sound from the past, it raised more than memories. It suggested that someone somewhere was managing to make out better than we were. Was there a tinge of jealousy there? And it also made us aware that, lucky as we had been, we were still gregarious creatures by nature. The restless feeling that the machine left behind destroyed our mood and the lines along which our thoughts had been running. In unspoken argument, we began to pack up our belongings, and each occupied with our thoughts, we made our way back to the half-track and started for home. Chapter 16. Contact. We had covered perhaps half the distance back to Scherning when Josella noticed the smoke. At first sight, it might have been a cloud, but as we neared the top of the hill, we could see the grey column beneath the more diffused upper layer. She pointed to it and looked at me without a word. The only fires we had seen in years had been a few spontaneous outbreaks in later summer. We both knew at once that the plume ahead was rising from the neighbourhood of Scherning. I forced the half-track along at a greater speed than it had ever done on the deteriorated roads. We were thrown about inside it, and yet still seemed to be crawling. Josella sat silent all the time, her lips pressed together and her eyes fixed on the smoke. I knew that she was searching for some indication that the source was nearer or further away anywhere but at Scherning itself. But the closer we came, the less room there was for doubt. We tore up the final lane, quite oblivious of the stings whipping at the vehicle as it passed. Then, at the turn, we were able to see that it was not the house itself, but the wood pile that was ablaze. At the sound of the horn, Susan came running out to pull on the rope which opened the gate from a safe distance. She shouted something which was drowned in the rattle of our driving in. Her free hand was pointing not to the fire, but towards the front of the house. As we ran further into the yard, we could see the reason. Skillfully landed in the middle of our lawn, stood the helicopter. By the time we were out of the half-track, a man in leather jacket and breeches had come out of the house. He was tall, fair, and sunburned. At first glance, I had a feeling I had seen him somewhere before. He waved and grinned cheerfully as we hurried across. "Mr. Bill Mason, I presume. My name's Simpson. Ivan Simpson."
"I remember," said Josella. "You brought in a helicopter that night at the university buildings." "That's right. Clever of you to remember. But just to show you're not the only one with a memory, you are Josella Playton, author—"
"You're quite wrong," she interrupted him firmly. "I'm Josella Mason, author of David Mason."
"Ah,
yes. I've just been looking at the original edition, and a very creditable bit of craftsmanship too, if I may say so."
"Hold on a bit," I said. "That fire—"
"Oh, it's safe enough. Blowing away from the house, though I'm afraid most of your stock of wood has gone up."
"What happened?"
"That was Susan. She didn't mean me to miss the place. When she heard my engine, she grabbed a flamethrower and bounded out to start a signal as quickly as she could. The woodpile was handiest. No one could have missed what she did to that."
We went inside and joined the others.
"By the way," Simpson said to me, "Michael told me I was to be sure to start off with his apologies."
"To me?" I said, wondering.
"You were the only one who saw any danger in the Triffids, and he didn't believe you."
But do you mean to say you knew I was here?"
"We found out very roughly your probable location a few days ago, from a fellow we all have cause to remember, one Coker."
"So Coker came through too," I said. "After the shambles I saw at Tynesham, I had an idea the plague had got him."
Later on, when we'd had a meal and produced our best brandy, we got the story out of him. When Michael Beadley and his party had gone on, leaving Tynesham to the mercies and principles of Miss Durrant, they had not made for Beaminster, nor anywhere near it. They had gone northeast, into Oxfordshire. Miss Durrant's misdirection to us must have been deliberate, for Beaminster had never been mentioned. They had found there an estate which seemed at first to offer the group all it required,
and no doubt they could have entrenched themselves there as we had entrenched ourselves at Scherning. But as the menace of the Triffids increased, the disadvantages of the place became more obvious. In a year, both Michael and the Colonel were highly dissatisfied with the longer-term prospects there. A great deal of work had already been put into the place, but by the end of the second summer there was general agreement that it would be better to cut their losses. To build a community, they had to think in terms of years, a considerable number of years. They had also to bear in mind that the longer they delayed, the more difficult any move would be. What they needed was a place where they would have room to expand and develop, an area with natural defences which, once it had been cleared of Triffids, could economically be kept clear of them. Where they now were, a high proportion of their labour was occupied with maintaining fences, and as their numbers increased, the length of fence line would have to be increased. Clearly the best self-maintaining defence line would be water. To that end, they had held a discussion on the relative merits of various islands. It had been chiefly climate that had decided them in favour of the Isle of Wight, despite some misgivings over the area that would have to be cleared. Accordingly, in the following March, they had packed up again and moved on. "When we got there," Ivan said, "the Triffid seemed even thicker than where we'd left. No sooner had we begun to settle ourselves into a big country house near God's Hill than they started collecting along the walls in thousands. We let them come for a couple of weeks or so, then we went for them with the flamethrowers. After we'd wiped that lot out, we let them accumulate again, and then we blitzed them once more, and so on. We could afford to do it properly there, because once we were clear of them, we'd not need to use the throwers any more. There could only be a limited number in the island, and the more of them that came round us to be wiped out, the better we liked it. We had to do it a dozen times before there was any appreciable effect. All round the walls we had a belt of charred stumps before they began to get shy. There were a devil of a lot more of them than we had expected. There used to be at least half a dozen nurseries breeding high-quality plants in the island. Not to mention the private and park ones," I said. "That doesn't surprise me. There might have been 100 nurseries by the look of it. Before all this began, I'd have said there were only a few thousand of the things in the whole country, if anyone had asked me. But there must have been hundreds of thousands." "There were," I said. "They'll grow practically anywhere, and they were pretty profitable. There didn't seem to be so many when they were penned up in farms and nurseries. All the same, judging from the amount round here, there must be whole tracts of country practically free of them now." "That's so," he agreed. "But go and live there, and they'll start collecting in a few days. You can see that from the air. I'd have known there was someone here without Susan's fire. They make a dark border round any inhabited place." "Still, we managed to thin down the crowd round our walls after a bit. Maybe they got to find it unhealthy, or maybe they didn't care a lot for walking about on the charred remains of their relatives. And of course there were fewer of them. So then we started going out to hunt them instead of just letting them come to us. It was our main job for months. Between us, we covered every inch of the island. Or thought we did. By the time we were through, we reckoned we'd put paid to everyone in the place, big and small. Even so, some managed to appear the next year, and the year after that. Now we have an intensive search every spring on account of seeds blowing over from the mainland, and settle with them right away. While that was going on, we were getting organized. There were some 50 or 60 of us to begin with. I took flips in the helicopter, and when I saw signs of a group anywhere, I'd go down and issue a general invitation to come along. Some did, but a surprising number simply weren't interested. They'd escaped from being governed, and in spite of all their troubles, they didn't want any more of it. There are some lots in South Wales that have made sorts of tribal communities, and resent the idea of any organisation except the minimum they set up for themselves. You'll find similar lots near the other coal fields, too. Usually the leaders are the men who happen to be on the shift below ground so that they never saw the green stars, though God knows how they ever got up the shafts again. Some of them so definitely don't want to be interfered with that they shoot at the aircraft. There's one lot of that sort at Brighton." "I know," I said. "They warn me off, too." "Oh, recently there are more like that. There's one at Maidstone, another at Guildford, and other places. They're the real reason we hadn't spotted you hidden away here before. The district didn't seem too healthy when one got close to it. I don't know what they think they're doing. Probably got some good food dumps and are scared of anyone else wanting some of it. Anyway, there's no sense in taking risks, so I just let them stew. Still, quite a lot did come along. In a year, we'd got up to 300 or so. Not all sighted, of course. It wasn't until about a month ago that I came across Coker and his lot, and one of the first things he asked, by the way, was whether you'd shown up. They had a bad time, particularly at first. A few days after he got back to Tynesham, a couple of women came along from London and brought the plague with them. Coker quarantined them at the first symptoms, but it was too late. He decided on a quick move. Miss Durrant wouldn't budge. She elected to stay and look after the sick and follow later if she could. She never did. They took the infection with them. There were three more hurried moves before they succeeded in shaking free of it. By then they'd gone as far west as Devonshire, and they were all right for a bit there. But then they began to find the same difficulties as we had, and you have. Coker stuck it out there for nearly 3 years, and then reasoned along much the same lines as we did. Only he didn't think of an island. Instead, he decided on a river boundary and a fence to cut off the toe of Cornwall. When they got there, they spent the first months building their barrier, then they went for the Triffids inside, much as we did on the island. They had much more difficult country to work with, though, and they never did succeed in clearing them out completely. The fence was fairly successful to begin with, but they never could trust it as we could the sea, and too much of their manpower had to be wasted on patrols. Coker thinks they might have made out all right once the children had grown old enough to work, but it would have been tough going all the time. When I did find them, they hadn't much hesitation about coming along. They set about loading up their fishing boats right away, and they were all on the island in a couple of weeks. When Coker found you weren't with us, he suggested you might still be somewhere in these parts. "You can tell him that wipes out any hard feelings about him," said Josella. "He's going to be a very useful man," Ivan said. "And from what he tells us, you could be too," he added, looking at me. "You're a biochemist, aren't you?"
"A biologist," I said, "with a little biochemistry."
"Well, you can hold on to your fine distinctions. Point is, Michael has tried to get some research going into a method of knocking off Triffids scientifically. That has to be found if we're going to get anywhere at all. But the trouble so far is that the only people we have to work on it are a few who have forgotten most of the biology they learnt at school. What do you think? Like to turn professor? It'd be a worthwhile job."
"I can't think of one that would be more worthwhile," I told him.
"Does this mean you're inviting us all to your island haven?" Dennis asked.
"Well, to come on mutual approval, at least," Ivan replied.
"Bill and Gisella will probably remember the broad principles laid down that night at the university. They still stand. We aren't out to reconstruct, we want to build something new and better. Some people don't take to that. If they don't, they're no use to us. We just aren't interested in having an opposition party that's trying to perpetuate a lot of the old bad features. We'd rather that people who want that went elsewhere."
"Elsewhere sounds a pretty poor offer in the circumstances," remarked Dennis.
"Oh, I don't mean we throw them back to the Triffids. But there were a number of them, and there had to be some place for them to go, so a party went across to the Channel Isles, and started cleaning up there on the same lines as we'd cleaned up the Isle of Wight. About 100 of them moved over. They're doing all right there, too. So now we have the mutual approval system. Newcomers spend 6 months with us, then there's a council hearing. If they don't like our ways, they say so. And if we don't think they'll fit, we say so. If they fit, they stay. If not, we see that they get to the Channel Isles. Or back to the mainland, if they're odd enough to prefer that."
"Sounds to have a touch of the dictatorial. How's this council of yours formed?" Dennis wanted to know.
Ivan shook his head. "It'd take too long to go into constitutional questions now. The best way to learn about us is to come and find out. If you like us, you'll stay. But even if you don't, I think you'll find the Channel Isles a better spot than this is likely to be a few years from now." In the evening, after Ivan had taken off and vanished away to the southwest, I went and sat on my favourite bench in a corner of the garden. I looked across the valley, remembering the well-drained and tended meadows that had been there. Now it was far on the way back to the wild. The neglected fields were dotted with thickets, beds of reeds, and stagnant pools. The bigger trees were slowly drowning in the sodden soil. I thought of Coker, and his talk of the leader, the teacher, and the doctor, and of all the work that would be needed to support us on our few acres, of how it would affect each of us if we were to be imprisoned here, of the three blind ones still feeling useless and frustrated as they grew older, of Susan, who should have the chance of a husband and babies, of David, and Mary's little girl, and any other children there might be who would have to become labourers as soon as they were strong enough, of Gisella and myself having to work still harder as we became older, because there would be more to feed, and more work that must be done by hand. Then there were the Triffids, patiently waiting. I could see hundreds of them in a dark green hedge beyond the fence. There must be research. Some natural enemy, some poison, a debalancer of some kind. Something must be found to deal with them. There must be relief from other work for that. And soon. Time was on the Triffids' side. They had only to go on waiting while we used up our resources. First the fuel, then no more wire to mend the fences, and they or their descendants would still be waiting there when the wire rusted through. And yet Scherning had become our home. I sighed. There was a light step on the grass. Gisela came and sat down beside me. I put an arm round her shoulders. "What do they think about it?" I asked her.
"They're badly upset, poor things.
It must be hard for them to understand how the Triffids wait like that when they can't see them. And then they can find their way about here, you see. It must be dreadful to have to contemplate going to an entirely strange place when you're blind. They only know what we tell them. I don't think they properly understand how impossible it will become here. If it were not for the children, I believe they'd say no flatly. It's their place, you see. All they have left. They feel that very much." She paused. Then she added, "They think that. But of course, it's not really their place at all. It's ours, isn't it? We've worked hard for it." She put her hand on mine. "You've made and kept it for us, Bill. What do you think? Shall we stay a year or two longer?" "No," I said. "I worked because everything seemed to depend on me. Now, it seems rather futile."
"Oh, darling, don't. A knight errant isn't futile. You fought for all of us and kept the dragons away."
"It's mostly the children," I said.
"Yes, the children," she agreed.
"And all the time, you know, I've been hunted by Coca. The first generation laborers, the next savages. I think we had better admit defeat before it comes and go now." She pressed my hand.
"Not defeat, Bill, dear. Just, what's the word? A strategic withdrawal. We withdraw to work and plan for the day when we can come back. One day we will. You'll show us how to wipe out every one of these foul Triffids and get our land back from them for us."
"You've a lot of faith, darling."
"And why not?"
"Well, at least I'll be fighting them. But first we go. When?"
"Do you think we could have the summer out here? It could be a sort of holiday for all of us, with no preparations to make for the winter. We deserve a holiday too."
"I should think we could do that," I agreed. We sat watching the valley dissolve in the dusk. Gisela said,
"It's queer, Bill. Now I can go, I don't really want to. Sometimes it seemed like prison. But now it seems like treachery to leave it. You see, I've been happier here than ever in my life before, in spite of everything."
"As for me, my sweet, I wasn't even alive before. But we'll have better times yet, I promise you."
"It's silly, but I shall cry when we do go. I shall cry buckets. You mustn't mind," she said.
But as things fell out, we were all of us much too busy to cry.
Chapter 17. Strategic Withdrawal. There was, as Gisela had implied, no need for hurry. While we saw the summer out at Scherning, I could prospect a new home for us on the island, and make several journeys there to transport the most useful part of the stores and gear that we had collected. But meanwhile, the woodpile had been destroyed. We needed no more fuel than would keep the kitchen going for a few weeks, so the next morning, Susan and I set off to fetch coal. The half-track wasn't suitable for that job, so we took a four-wheel drive lorry. Although the nearest rail coal depot was only 10 miles away, the roundabout route, due to the blockage of some roads, and the bad condition of others, meant that it took us nearly the whole day.
There were no major mishaps, but it was drawing on to evening when we returned. As we turned the last corner of the lane, with the Triffid slashing at the truck as indefatigably as ever from the banks, we stared in astonishment. Beyond our gate, parked in our yard, stood a monstrous-looking vehicle. The sight so dumbfounded us that we sat gaping at it for some moments before Susan put on her helmet and gloves and climbed down to open the gate. After I had driven in, we went over together to look at the vehicle. The chassis, we saw, was supported on metal tracks, which suggested a military origin. The general effect was somewhere between a cabin cruiser and an amateur-built caravan. Susan and I looked at it, and then looked at one another with raised eyebrows. We went indoors to find out more about it. In the living room we found, in addition to the household, four men clad in grey-green ski suits. Two of them wore pistols holstered to the right hip. The other two had parked their submachine guns on the floor beside their chairs. As we came in, Josella turned a completely expressionless face towards us. "Here is my husband. Bill, this is Mr. Torrance. He tells us he is an official of some kind. He has proposals to make to us." I had never heard her voice colder. For a second, I failed to respond. The man she indicated did not recognize me, but I recalled him all right. Features that have faced you along sights get sort of set in your mind. Besides, there was that distinctive red hair. I remembered well the way that efficient young man had turned back my party in Hampstead. I nodded to him. Looking at me, he said, "I understand you are in charge here, Mr. Mason." "The place belongs to Mr. Brent here," I replied. "I mean that you are the organizer of this group." "In the circumstances, yes," I said. "Good." He had a "now we are going to get somewhere" air. "I am Commander Southeast Region," he added. He spoke as if that should convey something important to me. It did not. I said so. "It means," he amplified, "that I am the Chief Executive Officer of the Emergency Council for the Southeastern Region of Britain. As such, it happens to be one of my duties to supervise the distribution and allocation of personnel." "Indeed," I said. "I have never heard of this, council." "Possibly. We were equally ignorant of the existence of your group here until we saw your fire yesterday." I waited for him to go on. "When such a group is discovered," he said, "it is my job to investigate it and assess it and make the necessary adjustments. So you may take it that I am here officially." "On behalf of an official council, or does it happen to be a self-elected council?" Dennis inquired. "There has to be law and order," the man said stiffly. Then, with a change of tone, he went on, "This is a well-found place you have here, Mr. Mason." "Mr. Brent has," I corrected. "We will leave Mr. Brent out. He is only here because you made it possible for him to stay here." I looked across at Dennis. His face was set. "Nevertheless, it is his property," I said. "It was, I understand. But the state of society which gave sanction to his ownership no longer exists. Titles to property have therefore ceased to be valid. Furthermore, Mr. Brent is not cited, so that he cannot in any case be considered competent to hold authority." "Indeed," I said again. I had had a distaste for this young man and his decisive ways at our first meeting. Further acquaintance was doing nothing to mellow it. He went on. "This is a matter of survival. Sentiment cannot be allowed to interfere with the necessary practical measures. Now, Mrs. Mason has told me that you number 8 altogether. 5 adults, this girl, and 2 small children. All of you are sighted except these 3. He indicated Dennis, Mary, and Joyce. "That is so," I admitted. "That's quite disproportionate, you know. There'll have to be some changes here, I'm afraid. We have to be realistic in times like this." Josella's eye caught mine. I saw a warning in it. But in any case, I had no intention of breaking out just then. I had seen the red-headed man's direct methods in action, and I wanted to know more of what I was up against. Apparently he realized that I would. "I'd better put you in the picture," he said. "Briefly, it is this. Regional headquarters is at Brighton, London soon became too bad for us. But in Brighton we were able to clear and quarantine a part of the town, and we ran it. Brighton's a big place. When the sickness had passed and we could get about more, there were plenty of stores to begin with. More recently we have been running in convoys from other places. But that's folding up now. The roads are getting too bad for lorries, and they are having to go too far. It had to come, of course. We'd reckoned that we could last out there several years longer. Still, there it is. It's possible we undertook to look after too many from the start. Anyway, now we are having to disperse. The only way to keep going will be to live off the land. To do that, we've got to break up into smaller units. The standard unit has been fixed at 1 sighted person to 10 blind, plus any children. You have a good place here, fully capable of supporting 2 units. We shall allocate to you 17 blind persons, making 20 with the 3 already here, again, of course, plus any children they may have. I stared at him in amazement. You're seriously suggesting that 20 people and their children can live off this land, I said. Well, it's utterly impossible. We've been wondering whether we shall be able to support ourselves on it. He shook his head confidently. It is perfectly possible. And what I am offering you is the command of the double unit we shall install here. Frankly, if you do not care to take it, we shall put in someone else who will. We can't afford waste in these times. But just look at the place, I repeated. It simply can't do it. I assure you that it can, Mr. Mason. Of course, you'll have to lower your standards a bit. We all shall for the next few years, but when the children grow up a bit, you'll begin to have labour to expand with. For 6 or 7 years, it's going to mean personal hard work for you, I admit. That can't be helped. From then on, however, you'll gradually be able to relax until you are simply supervising. Surely that's going to make a good return for just a few years of the tougher going. Placed as you are now, what sort of future would you have? Nothing but hard work until you die in your tracks. And your children faced with working in the same way, just to keep going, not more than that. Where are the future leaders and administrators to come from in that kind of setup? Your way you'd be worn out and still in harness in another 20 years, and all your children would be yokels. Our way, you'll be the head of a clan that's working for you, and you'll have an inheritance to hand on to your sons. Comprehension began to come to me. I said, wonderingly, Am I to understand that you are offering me a kind of feudal seigneury? Ah, he said. I see you do begin to understand. It is, of course, the obvious and quite natural social and economic form for that state of things we are having to face now. There was no doubt whatever that the man was putting this forward as a perfectly serious plan. I evaded a comment on it by repeating myself. But the place just can't support that many. For a few years, undoubtedly, you'll have to feed them mostly on mashed triffids. There won't be any shortage of that raw material by the look of it. Cattle food, I said. But sustaining? Rich in the important vitamins, I'm told? And beggars, particularly blind beggars, can't be choosers. You're seriously suggesting that I should take on all these people and keep them on cattle fodder? Listen, Mr. Mason, if it were not for us, none of these blind people would be alive at all now, nor would their children. It's up to them to do what we tell them, take what we give them, and be thankful for whatever they get. If they like to refuse what we offer, well, that's their own funeral. I decided it would be unwise to say what I felt about his philosophy at the moment. I turned to another angle. I don't see. Tell me, just where do you and your council stand in all this? Supreme authority and legislative power is vested in the council. It will rule. It will also control the armed forces. Armed forces, I repeated blankly. Certainly. The forces will be raised as and when necessary by levies on what you call the seigneuries. In return, you will have the right to call on the council in cases of attack from outside or unrest within. I was beginning to feel a bit winded. An army? Surely a small mobile squad of police? I see you haven't grasped the wider aspect of the situation, Mr. Mason. This affliction we have had was not confined to these islands, you know. It was worldwide. Everywhere there is the same sort of chaos. That must be so, or we should have heard differently by now. And in every country there are probably a few survivors. Now, it stands to reason, doesn't it, that the first country to get on its feet again, and put itself in order, is also going to be the country to have the chance of bringing order elsewhere. Do you suggest that we should leave it to some other country to do this, and let it become the new dominant power in Europe, and possibly further afield? Obviously not. Clearly it is our national duty to get ourselves back on our feet as soon as possible, and assume the dominant status so that we can prevent dangerous opposition from organising against us. Therefore, the sooner we can raise a force adequate to discourage any likely aggressors, the better.
For some moments, silence lay on the room. Then Dennis laughed unnaturally.
Great God Almighty! We've lived through all this, and now the man proposes to start a war!
Torrance said shortly, I don't seem to have made myself clear. The word war is an unjustifiable exaggeration. It will be simply a matter of pacifying and administering tribes that have reverted to primitive lawlessness.
Unless, of course, the same benevolent idea happens to have occurred to them, Dennis suggested.
I became aware that both Josella and Susan were looking at me very hard. Josella pointed at Susan, and I perceived the reason.
Let me get this straight, I said. You expect the three of us, who can see, to be entirely responsible here for 20 blind adults and an unspecified number of children. It seems to me blind people aren't quite incapable. They can do a lot, including for their own children in general, and helping to prepare their own food. Properly arranged, a great deal can be reduced to supervision and direction. But it will be two of you, Mr. Mason, yourself and your wife, not three.
I looked at Susan, sitting up very straight in her blue boiler suit with a red ribbon in her hair. There was an anxious appeal in her eyes as she looked from me to Josella.
Three, I said.
I'm sorry, Mr. Mason, the allocation is 10 per unit. The girl can come to headquarters. We can find useful work for her there until she is old enough to take charge of a unit herself.
My wife and I regard Susan as our own daughter, I told him shortly. I repeat, I am sorry, but those are the regulations.
I regarded him for some moments. He looked steadily back at me. At last,
we should, of course, require guarantees and undertakings regarding her if this had to happen, I said.
I was aware of several quickly drawn breaths. Torrance's manner relaxed slightly.
Naturally, we shall give you all practicable assurances, he said.
I nodded.
I must have time to think it all over. It's quite new to me, and rather startling. Some points come to my mind at once. Equipment here is wearing out. It is difficult to find more that has not deteriorated. I can see that before long I'm going to need good, strong, working horses.
Horses are difficult. There's very little stock at present. You'll probably have to use manpower teams for a while.
Then, I said, there's accommodation. The outbuildings are too small for our needs now, and I can't put up even prefabricated quarters single-handed.
There we shall be able to help you, I think. We went on discussing details for 20 minutes or more. By the end of it, I had him showing something like affability. Then I got rid of him by sending him off on a tour of the place with Susan as his sulky guide.
Bill, what on earth?
Josella began, as the door closed behind him and his companions. I told her what I knew of Torrance and his method of dealing with trouble by shooting it early.
That doesn't surprise me at all, remarked Dennis. But you know, what is surprising me now is that I'm suddenly feeling quite kindly towards the Triffids. Without their intervention, I suppose there would have been a whole lot more of this kind of thing by now. If they are the one factor that can stop serfdom coming back, then good luck to them.
The whole thing's clearly preposterous, I said. It doesn't have a chance. How could Josella and I look after a crowd like that and keep the Triffids out?
But, I added, we're scarcely in a position to give a flat no to a proposition put up by four armed men.
Then you're not, darling, I said. Do you really see me in the position of a seigneur, driving my serfs and villeins before me with a whip, even if the Triffids haven't overrun me first?
But you said...
Listen, I said. It's getting dark. Too late for them to leave now. They'll have to stay the night.
I imagine that tomorrow the idea will be to take Susan away with them. She'd make quite a good hostage for our behaviour, you see. And they might leave one or two of the others to keep an eye on us.
Well, I don't think we're taking that, are we?
No, but...
Well, I hope I've convinced him now that I'm coming round to his idea. Tonight, we'll have the sort of supper that might be taken to imply accord. Make it a good one. Everybody's to eat plenty. Give the kids plenty, too. Lay on our best drinks. See that Torrance and his chaps have plenty, but the rest of us go very easy. Towards the end of the meal, I shall disappear for a bit. You keep the party going to cover up. Play rowdy records at them or something. And everybody help to whoop it up. Another thing, nobody must mention Michael Beadley and his lot. Torrance must know about the Isle of Wight's set-up, but he doesn't think we do. Now, what I'll be wanting is a sack of sugar.
Sugar? Said Gisella blankly.
No? Well, a big can of honey, then. I should think that would do as well. Everyone played up very creditably at supper. The party not only thawed, it actually began to warm up. Gisella brought out some of her own potent mead to supplement the more orthodox drinks, and it went down well. The visitors were in a state of happily comfortable relaxation when I made my unobtrusive exit. I caught up a bundle of blankets and clothes and a parcel of food that I had laid ready, and hurried with them across the yard to the shed where we kept the half-track. With a hose from the tanker which held our main petrol supply, I filled the half-track's tanks to overflowing. Then I turned my attention to Torrance's strange vehicle. With the help of a hand dynamo torch, I managed to locate the filler cap and poured a quart or more of honey into the tank. The rest of the large can of honey I disposed of into the tanker itself. I could hear the party singing and seemingly still going well. After I had added some anti-Triffid gear and miscellaneous afterthoughts to the stuff already in the half-track, I went back and joined it until it finally broke up in an atmosphere which even a close observer might have mistaken for almost maudlin goodwill. We gave them 2 hours to get well asleep. The moon had risen, and the yard was bathed in white light. I had forgotten to oil the shed doors, and gave them a curse for every creak. The rest came in procession towards me. The Brents and Joyce were familiar enough with the place not to need a guiding hand. Behind them followed Gisella and Susan, carrying the children. David's sleepy voice rose once, and was stopped quickly by Josella's hand over his mouth. She got into the front, still holding him. I saw the others into the back, and closed it. Then I climbed into the driving seat, kissed Josella, and took a deep breath. Across the yard, the Triffids were clustering closer to the gate, as they always did when they had been undisturbed for some hours. By the grace of heaven, the half-track's engine started at once. I slammed into low gear, swerved to avoid Torrance's vehicle, and drove straight at the gate. The heavy fender took it with a crash. We plunged forward in a festoon of wire netting and broken timbers, knocking down a dozen Triffids while the rest slashed furiously at us as we passed. Then we were on our way. Where a turn in the climbing track let us look down on Sherning, we paused and cut the engine. Lights were on behind some of the windows, and as we watched, those on the vehicle blazed out, floodlighting the house. A starter began to grind. I had a twinge of uneasiness as the engine fired, though I knew we had several times the speed of that lumbering contraption. The machine began to jerk round on its tracks to face the gate. Before it completed the turn, the engine sputtered and stopped. The starter began to whir again. It went on whirring, irritably, and without result. The Triffids had discovered that the gate was down. By a blend of moonlight and reflected headlights, we could see their tall, slender forms already swaying in ungainly procession into the yard, while others came lurching down the banks of the lane to follow them. I looked at Gisella. She was not crying buckets, not crying at all. She looked from me down to David asleep in her arms.
"I've all I really need," she said. "And some day you're going to bring us back to the rest, Bill."
Wifely confidence is a very nice trait, darling, but... No. Damn it, no buts. I am going to bring you back, I said. I got out to clear the debris from the front of the half-track, and wiped the poison from the windscreen so that I should be able to see to drive on and away across the tops of the hills towards the southwest. And there my personal story joins up with the rest. You will find it in Elspeth Carey's excellent history of the colony. Our hopes all centre here now. It seems unlikely that anything will come of Torrance's neo-feudal plan, though a number of his seigneuries do still exist with their inhabitants leading, so we hear, a life of squalid wretchedness behind their stockades. But there are not so many of them as there were. Every now and then Ivan reports that another has been overrun, and that the Triffids which surrounded it have dispersed to join other sieges. So we must regard the task ahead as ours alone. We think now that we can see the way. But there is still a lot of work and research to be done before the day when we, or our children, or their children, will cross the narrow straits on the great crusade to drive the Triffids back and back with ceaseless destruction, until we have wiped the last one of them from the face of the land that they have usurped.